You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today I'm only going to cover one story. This will be another short show, probably about 30 minutes. And the story is somewhat breaking in that it's the first press conference of Janet Yellen, who's the Federal Reserve Chairman. She took over for Ben Bernanke, who retired, decided not to seek another term. I think he could have had it if he wanted it, but after about 8 years, I think he had enough of it, and I can understand why, because that's a job that you're going to get a lot of criticism across the board. Now, I haven't had time to listen to the entire press conference. I try to go over her statement, but usually after her statement, and it's a fairly brief statement, there are questions, and I really did not have time to listen to all the questions and, more importantly, the answers that she gave. Two things that are fairly new, but rather not unexpected, is that in March, the Federal Reserve will continuing tapering, and what I'm referring to is the Federal Reserve has been buying both Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities. And it was at $85 billion a month. It's starting in March, it will be at $55 billion. So they're gradually tapering. And she did announce by the end of the fall that will stop. So if we're at $55 billion a month, I could see it probably is going to fall about $5 billion a month here on out to eventually gets to zero in December. Now, keep in mind, what's driving this? What's pacing this? What's the why $55 billion? Why not zero? What's going on here? And a lot of people lose the big picture or even ignore the big picture. The federal government has been running massive deficits. They're still continuing to run massive deficits. And I've gone over it and over it and over it in past shows, but summarize it here. In 2009, the deficit was, for fiscal year 2009, give you round numbers, $1.4 trillion. Then in 10, it dropped to $1.3. 11, fiscal years here. And remember, fiscal year starts in 1 October the previous year and ends, if it's fiscal year like we're in fiscal year 2014 right now, it will end 30 December. And the new fiscal year starts for fiscal year 2015 would start 1 October this year and end the following September. So I'm talking fiscal years. So we started out in 2009 fiscal year with 1.4, then 1.3, slightly under 1.3, 1.1, a little bit under 1.1, and last year it was at $680 billion, which is over half a trillion. These are unprecedented deficits. And what is a deficit? A deficit is where the federal government spends more money. All total expenditures exceed all total tax revenues. And we've been doing it over and over and over again. Now, I'm not against debt, nor rather small deficits. But these are huge. These are massive. So when you're spending more money than you're collecting, what do you do and what does the government do? What you do usually is to either take out a loan or charge it on your credit card. Now, the federal government does not have a credit card. Some of its employees do, but what I'm talking is the total federal government. What it does is what the U.S. Treasury Department does is it issues Treasury securities. And they vary as to the length of the loans. These are loans to the federal government. Think of it that way. It could be short-term like bills or notes or bonds, which is long-term, 10 years or more. Most of what the federal government recently has been issuing are notes, 10-year notes. Why are they doing it? It's to pay the bills. They do not have the money to pay the bills. Now, how bad is that? It's roughly out of every dollar the federal government has been spending, approximately 35% or 35 cents on the dollar has to be borrowed. Who does the federal government borrow the money from? Individuals such as American citizens, but also by far financial institutions. commercial banks, investment banks, insurance companies, investment firms, and not only just in the United States, in the world. Those are the people that buy Treasury securities. Why do they buy it? They're perceived by the investor class, and this is the investor class, to be safe or relatively safe, and they are. And there's a massive market in Treasury securities. It's by far the largest security asset class in terms of just size. And you typically have, for example, government securities, which this is, but you also have cities, states, counties borrow money. Those are government debts. And in the private sector, corporations can borrow the money, bonds, issue bonds, or they can issue equity. That's sort of the big picture. The point I'm trying to make is when the federal government, to pay its bills, doesn't have enough money, they have to increase the debt of the United States. Today, that debt is in total outstanding, is total outstanding public debt of the United States is over $17.4 trillion. Because every year when you run these large deficits, don't confuse deficits with debt. A lot of people make that mistake. When you spend more money than you're getting in terms of taxes, that is a deficit. You'll hear the numbers annual deficit. That's what I'm referring to. But to pay for those deficits, the federal government issues debt, treasury debt, and that typically takes the form of either treasury bills, notes, or bonds. Who buys it besides financial institutions, both in the United States and abroad, as well as individuals in the United States and abroad, foreign governments? And they hold those as reserves. Now, here's the problem. When you consistently, as the United States government has done, racked up these large, huge deficits, and in turn means a terrific expansion of the federal debt to unprecedented levels, the perception is by the investor class, and that's institutions as well as individuals, is this asset, or, and let me explain this. If you're an investor, one and you buy, not sell, buying Treasury securities, it's considered an asset. You're investing in Treasury securities, whatever the reason. But you want to make sure that the return you get on the money you're lending meets your requirements. In other words, first thing you got to take into consideration is inflation. Inflation has been, if you believe the federal government and the Federal Reserve, been rather mild, under 2%. Some will argue with that. I will argue with that. Not here, but inflation is relatively low, at least in the United States. I mean, that's the perception. And the Federal Reserve will cite that. Inflation rates are under 2%. And they'll give their predictions as to where inflation is going. Now, they're seeing it trending upwards, but a point I'm trying to make is others that invest have to think ahead. And that's one of the points I'm going to make. If you're an investor or a business owner or an individual, you need to be looking ahead. It's like driving a car. If you want to drive a car and not have a wreck, you can't be looking in the back mirror, in the rear view mirror. Because if you could do that for any length of time, the chances are you're going to hit somebody because you're paying attention what's behind you and not paying attention what's in front of you. And that's the key point I'm going to be making. It's a trap to look at the past and to think that the past will just be extended indefinitely into the future. Now, I'm not saying the Fed does this, although I think it does it more than they think, because economic predictions are highly not precise. They can make it short term, but when you get beyond a year, it falls apart. And the Fed has a rather terrible track record of doing this. You see, what they're trying to do is anticipate what the marketplace is going to do. And knowledge is distributed amongst billions of people. There's no way a small group of PhDs in economics can replicate the market system because knowledge is distributed worldwide amongst individuals. And depending on the prices, people make decisions. Today, one of the reasons this show is going to be short is I had to stop in Walmart as well as a gas station coming here. And I did a little I shouldn't have done in the Walmart, but I wanted to get something. And I shopped and got the goods that I was looking for. And I knew roughly what I was going to pay or wanted to pay. I needed a new belt. So I looked at some bells, and I expected it to be somewhere between $8 and $20. It depends on the quality of the material. I paid $12. A little bit high, but I was expecting to pay somewhere between $8, $10, or $12. If I had time, I could have shopped it. I could have spent some more time, more gasoline, going into several other places. I didn't have the time. And I'm trying to use this as an illustration. There's no way the Federal Reserve can get that information that it needs to make to replicate the market. The fastest computer in the world can't do it. Why? People are continually changing their choices in terms of the goods and services they want. And it's based on certain expectations of what a certain good should cost. Now, at one time, I wouldn't spend $12 for a belt. You could pay a lot more money for, if you want to get a good belt, you could easily pay $50. It depends what you're looking for. And people's taste as well as preferences change, as does their economic situation, and as does the time they have to shop. Some people are very, very busy and are willing to pay a lot more so they can get whatever they need fast. They're very much convenience-oriented in speed. It's not that they don't take advantage of bargains. It's they simply don't have the time. Now, I was somewhat rushed, but I knew roughly what I was going to have to pay. In my mind, between $8 and $20. And most of the belts that Walmart had, they're going to be on the low end. I knew that, but not the lowest. We're going to be between $8 and $20, and they were. I think the most expensive belt in there, I think, was about $16. And the problem I had, I needed to find one that fit my size. And although I've been on a diet, I've been kind of going up and down. Can't understand exactly what's going on here. But that's an aside. The point I'm going to make is multiply that by not millions of people, billions of people. That's why a command and control central economy such as you had in the Soviet Union and in communist China never works. They need the price system, and that's the next point I'm going to be making. The key decision in when I was buying that belt first was price. If I went in there and, for example, if every belt that this store had were $50, I wasn't going to buy it. I would postpone my purchase and shop. Other people that are where time is limited wouldn't. They would grab the first thing if they really needed a new belt, and I did. Now multiply, so here's the challenge. Think about it. You have billions of people in the world, not just U.S. consumers. You have over 318 million U.S. consumers. That's point one. Point two is you have hundreds of thousands, millions of goods and services, each with a price. And those prices are changing periodically or every day, every minute, they're changing someplace. You don't believe me? Go to your local grocery store. You'll see sales, and people take advantage of it. I do. Talk to anyone that shops. A lot of people, including me, will wait for sales. They know that whatever they usually have a limited list of goods, whether it's food or beverage or other accessories that you need to run a household. They have a list, and they know in any period of time, a month, a week, a month, they're going to buy this. But if they're on a limited budget, what do? They look for the sales. Now, what does this have to do with Federal Reserve policy? What, in essence, is the Federal Reserve doing? One is they're setting the price of money, and that price is the federal funds interest rate, the overnight interest rate. You can't get that interest rate, by the way, because it's near zero. It's 25 basis points, or 0.25%. It's been that way since December 2008. In essence, what the Federal Reserve has done is pegged or fixed the federal funds rate at what's called near zero. You can't get much closer than 25 basis points. Now, why did they do that? It's not hard to understand. They needed to recapitalize the banks because the banks were, a lot of them were taken over and sold because they were insolvent. In other words, their liabilities exceeded their assets. This is sort of basic accounting, but when you're in that situation, technically you are insolvent. Now, why were they insolvent? The value of their assets dramatically declined. This happened in the period of 2006, 2007, 2008. And many banks had mortgage-backed securities that dramatically declined in value. So on the asset side of your balance sheet, if your assets dramatically fall, what happens? Your liabilities exceed both the assets that you have and the owner's equity. That's a place you don't want to be because you are insolvent. And what the federal government is tasked to do, the regulators and the FDIC is tasked to do, is to close those banks. They should be closed. They are insolvent. And hundreds of banks were closed, but not the ones that were too big to fail. So what the Federal Reserve was doing, starting in 2008, 2009, and 10, and continuing, is to provide a period of time to recapitalize the banks, to get them in a better position where they're definitely solvent. And because I'm mentioning it, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying all banks were insolvent. That is not true. But many banks were. Many of the large banks were. So one of the roles of the Federal Reserve is to be a lender of last resort. In other words, as the asset values of the banks decline, especially their mortgage-backed securities, fell in value, significantly fell in value, as a result of the crash, the real estate market crashing. There was a lot of speculation in it. Prices shot up, but eventually went down. A lot of that speculation, and there are a lot of reasons for it, but one of the principal causes of it was a loose monetary policy, an easy monetary policy, the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve didn't see this coming. And I'm not going to play, but I could play audio clips of statements that the Federal Reserve, previous chairman, made. You see, one of the responsibilities of the Federal Reserve is to regulate the banks and make sure they don't get in this situation. They frankly didn't do a very good job of that, and that's being very diplomatic. I think they failed at it. Call that an instance of government failure. I consider the Federal Reserve as being a creature of the Congress, and it's really a government institution. It's a mix of both. I understand that, and they're supposedly independent, but not really. Because what the Federal Reserve was doing is trying, by being a lender or a last resort, preventing many financial institutions should have been closed. They shouldn't have been bailed out. That's not the course of action that the Federal Reserve pursued. They made it very easy for not only commercial banks or depository institutions to get loans, but also institutions that really shouldn't have gotten loans, namely investment banks and non-depository institutions, including insurance companies. Now, some will say, well, they needed to do this. You know, the financial system was going to crash. Yeah, but why? One of the reasons is government intervention into the marketplace, in this case, for money. The point I'm trying to lead up to is most central banks today, including the Federal Reserves, are a classic example, as far as I'm concerned, of government intervention into the marketplace, where the belief is that a small group of people, well-intentioned, intelligent, some would say wise, I do not, think they know what needs to be done. Some would say they did a terrific job. A matter of fact, many would say they did a terrific job. In terms of preventing a complete collapse of the financial system, okay, I agree with that. I could go along with, not happy with, but I can go along with so-called quantitative easing one. And what the Fed was trying to do is provide a means for, well, the first thing they did was lend a lot of money to banks, many of them that didn't need the money but were forced to take it at the insistence of the Treasury Department and the Fed. Now, what's happened over time is most of those banks, except the ones that were closed down and worked insolvent, have come back, roaring come back, having very profitable years. But the Fed also, well, has two problems. One is it has been financing the federal government's deficits by buying not only mortgage-backed securities, but also treasury securities. And that's what this press conference, one of the items that discuss, we will be tapering or ending our tapering in the fall of this year. And I interpret that to be in sometime in December. They'll finally get to zero. I'm totally against quantitative easing 3, but that's what they're doing. They're enabling the source of the problem. You see, the people that run the Fed, most of the economists in the Federal Reserve, as well as in the government, or Keynesian economics, that are big believers in government intervention into the economy. The cause of booms and bust is government intervention in the economy, either by the federal government or the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States. Now, it's not hard to understand what the Fed is about. It is creating what economists call a wealth effect, an easy monetary policy, which we've had since December 2008 with this near zero interest rate. What does that encourage? It encourages investments, but also speculation. And we've had a boom in the stocks. The way I think of it, it's like a drug addict. You're giving him more and more drugs, but eventually you're going to stop giving him drugs. I had a conversation with someone just before the show, not on drugs, but it was on computer software. But the point I was made to him was, it's like a drug dealer saying, here, take a little. It's free. It's free. Yeah, it's free for a while. But then the drug dealer wants to get paid for it. They want to get you hooked. Now, if you're employed or successful and invested in stocks, you've been amply rewarded as a result of this easy monetary policy. But eventually, the Fed rally, which we've had with these near zero interest rates and this the Fed enabling the federal government to do this, what has been some of the negative impacts that they won't admit to? What has this done to U.S. savings, which has always been a problem, has always been low? What are the interest rates you can get on a CD or at your savings? They're near zero, too. This has destroyed people that used to save. And that's why you've had these rallies, people looking for a higher interest rate. The only way they can get it is to make more risky investments and go into stocks. Now, I think you should be in stocks. Don't get me wrong. Depends on your situation. But I'm not going to impose my preferences, including risk preferences, on you. The people that most have been really affected here are the savers. And you need savings to increase. Savings is a prerequisite. You know, individuals have two choices when they get an income. They can spend it, or they can save. And when you get very low interest rates, what do most people do unless they have a large income? They spend it. That's what they're about. That's what they've been doing for the last 6 years. But they don't think long term. As a matter of fact, what they're really doing is spending a lot of time looking at that rear view mirror. And to the extent that they're not looking at the rear view mirror, they're looking about a block ahead at most. And they don't understand the permanent damage it is doing to the U.S. economy. As far as I'm concerned, quantitative easing 3, which is the printing of money, or a more accurate way to say is creating the money. And that's what the Fed has been doing when it buys Treasury securities. Because what are they technically doing? They're issuing federal notes. Those are IOUs that the government then can use to pay off. It's the money in your wallet. Pull out a dollar bill or a $10 or $20 bill. It's a Federal Reserve note. That's an IOU. They're the only institution in the United States that can do that. I'm looking at the time. I'm going to have to wrap this up. I'll continue this story because I'm just getting warmed up to it, and I'll have more preparation tomorrow. But the point I'm trying to say is the Fed will be ending, which is, I think, a good thing. It's quantitative easing. And starting next year, we'll gradually be increasing the short-term interest rate, which is the federal funds rate, which is what they're targeting. My own solution and final point is I think as they were tapering, they should have been increasing the federal funds rate by about 25 basis point a quarter and do it gradually. Instead, they're postponing this. And what they're not factoring in, although they admit this could change everything, what happens if we get into another recession? You see, they're trying to get an exit strategy and hope that they can pull it off. But if we go into another recession, they can't. They can't tighten up. They'll go back to exactly what they're doing, and it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked because unemployment rates still remain persistently high. You're listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening, and now back to the music.